winding flight of stairs, intent on his own meditations, which, like those of most of the denizens of the maze, had to do with the unlawful acquirement of property. Part way down the stairs, he halted suddenly, his hair standing up. A vague bulk crouched in the darkness before him. A pair of eyes blazed like the eyes of a hunting beast. A beast-like snarl was the last thing he heard in life as the monster lurched against him and a keen blade ripped through his belly. He gave one gasping cry and slumped down limply on the stairway. The barbarian loomed above him for an instant, ghoul-like, his eyes burning in the gloom. He knew the sound was heard, but the people in the maze were careful to attend to their own business. A death cry on darkened stairs was nothing unusual. Later, someone would venture to investigate, but only after a reasonable lapse of time. Conan went up the stairs and halted at a door he knew well of old. It was fastened within, but his blade passed between the door and the jamb and lifted the bar. He stepped inside, closing the door after him, and faced the girl who had betrayed him to the police. The wench was sitting cross-legged in her shift on an unkempt bed. She turned white and stared at him as if at a ghost. She had heard the cry from the stairs, and she saw the red stain on the poniard in his hand. But she was too filled with terror on her own account to waste any time lamenting the evident fate of her lover. She began to beg for her life, almost incoherent with terror. Conan did not reply. He merely stood and glared at her with his burning eyes, testing the edge of his poniard with a calloused thumb. At last, he crossed the chamber, while she cowered back against the wall, sobbing frantic pleas for mercy. Grasping her yellow locks with no gentle hand, he dragged her off the bed. Thrusting his blade back in its sheath, he tucked his squirming captive under his left arm and strode to the window. Like most houses of that type, a ledge encircled each story, caused by the continuance of the window ledges. Conan kicked the window open and stepped out on that narrow band. If any had been near or awake, they would have witnessed the bizarre sight of a man moving carefully along the ledge, carrying a kicking, half-naked wench under his arm. They would have been no more puzzled than the girl. Reaching the spot he sought, Conan halted, gripping the wall with his free hand. Inside the building rose a sudden clamor, showing that the body had at last been discovered. His captive whimpered and twisted, renewing her importunities. Conan glanced down into the muck and slime of the alleys below. He listened briefly to the clamor inside and the pleas of the wench. Then he dropped her with great accuracy into a cesspool. He enjoyed her kickings and flounderings and the concentrated venom of her profanity for a few seconds, and even allowed himself a low rumble of laughter. Then he lifted his head, listened to the growing tumult within the building, and decided it was time for him to kill Nabonidus. 3. It was a reverberating clang of metal that roused Murillo. He groaned and struggled dazedly to a sitting posture. About him, all was silence and darkness, and for an instant he was sickened with the fear that he was blind. Then he remembered what had gone before, and his flesh crawled. By the sense of touch, he found that he was lying on a floor of evenly joined stone slabs. Further groping discovered a wall of the same material. He rose and leaned against it, trying in vain to orient himself. That he was in some sort of a prison seemed certain, but where and how long he was unable to guess. He remembered dimly a clashing noise, and wondered if it had been the iron door of his dungeon closing on him, or if it betokened the entrance of an executioner. At this thought he shuddered profoundly and began to feel his way along the wall. Momentarily, he expected to encounter the limits of his prison, but after a while he came to the conclusion that he was traveling down a corridor. He kept to the wall, fearful of pits or other traps, and was presently aware of something near him in the blackness. He could see nothing, but either his ears had caught a stealthy sound or some subconscious sense warned him. He stopped short, his hair standing on end. As surely as he lived, he felt the presence of some living creature crouching in the darkness in front of him. He thought his heart would stop when a voice hissed in a barbaric accent.
Marilo, is it you? Conan!
Limp from the reaction, the young nobleman groped in the darkness, and his hands encountered a pair of great naked shoulders.
Good thing I recognized you, grunted the barbarian. I was about to stick you like a fattened pig.
Where are we in Mitra's name?
In the pits under the Red Priest's house. But why?
What is the time?
Not long after midnight.
Marilo shook his head, trying to assemble his scattered wits.
What are you doing here?
Demanded the Cimmerian.
I came to kill Nabonidus. I heard they had changed the guard at your prison.
They did, growled Conan. I broke the new jailer's head and walked out. I would have been here hours agone, but I had some personal business to attend to. Well, shall we hunt for Nabonidus?
Marilo shuddered.
Conan, we are in the house of the Archfiend. I came seeking a human enemy. I found a hairy devil out of hell.
Conan grunted uncertainly. Fearless as a wounded tiger as far as human foes were concerned, he had all the superstitious dreads of the primitive.
I gained access to the house,
whispered Marilo, as if the darkness were full of listening ears.
In the outer gardens I found Nabonidus's dog mauled to death. Within the house I came upon Joka, the servant. His neck had been broken. Then I saw Nabonidus himself seated in his chair, clad in his accustomed garb. At first I thought he too was dead. I stole up to stab him. He rose and faced me. Gods!
The memory of that horror struck the young nobleman momentarily speechless as he relived that awful instant.
Conan, he whispered, it was no man that stood before me. In body and posture it was not unlike a man, but from the scarlet hood of the priest grinned a face of madness and nightmare. It was covered with black hair, from which small pig-like eyes glared redly. Its nose was flat, with great flaring nostrils. Its loose lips writhed back, disclosing huge yellow fangs like the teeth of a dog. The hands that hung from the scarlet sleeves were misshapen and likewise covered with black hair. All this I saw in one glance, and then I was overcome with horror. My senses left me, and I swooned.
What then? Muttered the Cimmerian uneasily.
I recovered consciousness only a short time ago. The monster must have thrown me into these pits. Conan, I have suspected that Nabonidus was not wholly human. He is a demon, a were-thing. By day he moves among humanity in the guise of men, and by night he takes on his true aspect.
That's evident, answered Conan. Everyone knows there are men who take the form of wolves at will. But why did he kill his servants?
Who can delve the mind of a devil?
Replied Marilo.
Our present interest is in getting out of this place. Human weapons cannot harm a were-man. How did you get in here?
Through the sewer. I reckoned on the gardens being guarded. The sewers connect with a tunnel that lets into these pits. I thought to find some door leading up into the house unbolted.
Then let us escape by the way you came, exclaimed Marilo. To the devil with it! Once out of this snake den, we'll take our chance with the king's guardsmen and risk a flight from the city. Lead on!
Useless, grunted the Cimmerian. The way to the sewers is barred. As I entered the tunnel, an iron grill crashed down from the roof. If I had not moved quicker than a flash of lightning, its spearheads would have pinned me to the floor like a worm. When I tried to lift it, it wouldn't move. An elephant couldn't shake it, nor could anything bigger than a rabbit squirm between the bars.
Marilo cursed, an icy hand playing up and down his spine. He might have known Nabonidus would not leave any entrance into his house unguarded. Had Conan not possessed the steel-spring quickness of a wild thing, that falling portcullis would have skewered him. Doubtless his walking through the tunnel had sprung some hidden catch that released it from the roof. As it was, both were trapped living.
"There's but one thing to do," said Murillo, sweating profusely. "That's to search for some other exit. Doubtless they're all set with traps, but we have no other choice."
The barbarian grunted agreement, and the companions began groping their way at random down the corridor. Even at that moment, something occurred to Murillo.
"How did you recognize me in this blackness?"
he demanded. "I smelled the perfume you put on your hair when you came to my cell," answered Conan. "I smelled it again a while ago, when I was crouching in the dark and preparing to rip you open." Murillo put a lock of his black hair to his nostrils. Even so, the scent was barely apparent to his civilized senses, and he realized how keen must be the organs of the barbarian. Instinctively, his hand went to his scabbard as they groped onward, and he cursed to find it empty. At that moment, a faint glow became apparent ahead of them, and presently they came to a sharp bend in the corridor, about which the light filtered grayly. Together, they peered around the corner, and Murillo, leaning against his companion, felt his huge frame stiffen. The young nobleman had also seen it. The body of a man, half naked, lying limply in the corridor beyond the bend, vaguely illumined by a radiance which seemed to emanate from a broad silver disc on the farther wall. A strange familiarity about the recumbent figure, which lay face down, stirred Murillo with inexplicable and monstrous conjectures. Motioning the Cimmerian to follow him, he stole forward and bent above the body. Overcoming a certain repugnance, he grasped it and turned it on its back. An incredulous oath escaped him. The Cimmerian grunted explosively.
"Nabonidus! The Red Priest!"
ejaculated Murillo, his brain a dizzy vortex of whirling amazement.
"But who? What?"
The priest groaned and stirred. With cat-like quickness, Conan bent over him, poniard poised above his heart. Murillo caught his wrist.
"Wait! Don't kill him yet!"
"Why not?" demanded the Cimmerian. "He has cast off his wear-guise and sleeps. Will you awaken him to tear us to pieces?"
"No, wait,"
urged Murillo, trying to collect his jumbled wits.
"Look, he is not sleeping. See that great blue welt on his shaven temple? He has been knocked senseless. He may have been lying here for hours."
"I thought you swore you saw him in beastly shape in the house above," said Conan.
"I did, or else... He's coming too. Keep back your blade, Conan. There is a mystery here even darker than I thought. I must have words with this priest before we kill him."
Nabonidus lifted a hand vaguely to his bruised temple, mumbled, and opened his eyes. For an instant, they were blank and empty of intelligence. Then, life came back to them with a jerk, and he sat up, staring at the companions. Whatever terrific jolt had temporarily addled his razor-keen brain, it was functioning with its accustomed vigor again. His eyes shot swiftly about him, then came back to rest on Murillo's face.
"You honor my poor house, young sir," he laughed coolly, glancing at the great figure that loomed behind the young nobleman's shoulder. "You have brought a bravo, I see. Was your sword not sufficient to sever the life of my humble self?"
"Enough of this," impatiently returned Murillo. "How long have you lain here?"
"A peculiar question to put to a man just recovering consciousness," answered the priest. "I do not know what time it now is, but it lacked an hour or so of midnight when I was set upon."
"Who is it that masquerades in your own gown in the house above?"
deemed Murillo.
"That will be Thack,"
answered Nabonidus, ruefully fingering his bruises.
"Yes, that will be Thack. And in my gown, the dog!"
Conan, who comprehended none of this, stirred restlessly and growled something in his own tongue. Nabonidus glanced at him whimsically.
"Your bully's knife yearns for my heart, Murillo," he said.
I thought you might be wise enough to take my warning and leave the city.
How was I to know that was to be granted me? Returned Murillo. At any rate, my interests are here.
You are in good company with that cutthroat, murmured Nabonidus. I had suspected you for some time. That was why I caused that pallid court secretary to disappear. Before he died, he told me many things, among others the name of the young nobleman who bribed him to filch state secrets, which the nobleman in turn sold to rival powers. Are you not ashamed of yourself, Murillo, you white-handed thief?
I have no more cause for shame than you, you vulture-hearted plunderer, answered Murillo promptly. You exploit a whole kingdom for your personal greed, and under the guise of disinterested statesmanship, you swindle the king, beggar the rich, oppress the poor, and sacrifice the whole future of the nation for your ruthless ambition. You are no more than a fat hog with his snout in the trough. You are a greater thief than I am. This Cimmerian is the most honest man of the three of us, because he steals and murders openly.
Well, then, we are all rogues together, agreed Nabonidus equably. And what now? My life?
When I saw the ear of the secretary that had disappeared, I knew I was doomed, said Murillo abruptly, and I believed you would invoke the authority of the king. Was I right?
Quite so, answered the priest. A court secretary is easy to do away with, but you are a bit too prominent. I had intended telling the king a jest about you in the morning.
A jest that would have cost me my head, muttered Murillo. Then the king is unaware of my foreign enterprises?
As yet, sighed Nabonidus. And now, since I see your companion has his knife, I fear that jest will never be told.
You should know how to get out of these rat dens, said Murillo. Suppose I agree to spare your life. Will you help us to escape and swear to keep silent about my thievery?
When did a priest keep an oath? Complained Conan, comprehending the trend of the conversation. Let me cut his throat. I want to see what color his blood is. They say in the maze that his heart is black, so his blood must be black too.
Be quiet, whispered Murillo. If he does not show us the way out of these pits, we may rot here. Well, Nabonidus, what do you say?
What does a wolf with his leg in the trap say? Laughed the priest. I am in your power, and if we are to escape, we must aid one another. I swear, if we survive this adventure, to forget all your shifty dealings. I swear by the soul of Mitra.
I am satisfied, muttered Murillo. Even the red priest would not break that oath. Now to get out of here. My friend here entered by way of the tunnel, but a grill fell behind him and blocked the way. Can you cause it to be lifted?
Not from these pits, answered the priest. The control lever is on the chamber above the tunnel. There is only one other way out of these pits, which I will show you. But tell me, how did you come here?
Murillo told him in a few words, and Nabonidus nodded, rising stiffly. He limped down the corridor, which here widened into a sort of vast chamber, and approached the distant silver disk. As they advanced, the light increased, though it never became anything but a dim, shadowy radiance. Near the disk, they saw a narrow stair leading upward.
That is the other exit, said Nabonidus, and I strongly doubt if the door at the head is bolted. But I have an idea that he who would go through that door had better cut his own throat first. Look into the disk.
What had seemed a silver plate was in reality a great mirror set in the wall. A confusing system of copper-like tubes jutted out from the wall above it, bending down toward it at right angles. Glancing into these tubes, Murillo saw a bewildering array of smaller mirrors. He turned his attention to the larger mirror in the wall and ejaculated in amazement. Peering over his shoulder, Conan grunted. They seemed to be looking through a broad window into a well-lighted chamber. There were broad mirrors on the walls, with velvet hangings between. There were silken couches, chairs of ebony and ivory, and curtained doorways leading off from the chamber. And before one doorway, which was not curtained, sat a bulky black object that contrasted grotesquely with the richness of the chamber. Murillo felt his blood freeze again as he looked at the horror which seemed to be staring directly into his eyes. Involuntarily, he recoiled from the mirror, while Conan thrust his head truculently forward till his jaws almost touched the surface, growling some threat or defiance in his own barbaric tongue.
"In Mitra's name, Nabonidus," gasped Murillo, shaken. "What is it?"
"That is Thak," answered the priest, caressing his temple. "Some would call him an ape, but he is almost as different from a real ape as he is different from a real man. His people dwell far to the east, in the mountains that fringe the eastern frontiers of Zamora. There are not many of them, but if they are not exterminated, I believe they will become human beings in perhaps 100,000 years. They are in the formative stage. They are neither apes, as their remote ancestors were, nor men, as their remote descendants may be. They dwell in the high crags of well-nigh inaccessible mountains, knowing nothing of fire, or the making of shelter or garments, or the use of weapons. Yet they have a language of a sort, consisting mainly of grunts and clicks. I took Thak when he was a cub, and he learned what I taught him much more swiftly and thoroughly than any true animal could have done. He was at once bodyguard and servant. But I forgot that being partly a man, he could not be submerged into a mere shadow of myself like a true animal. Apparently, his semi-brain retained impressions of hate, resentment, and some sort of bestial ambition of its own. At any rate, he struck when I least expected it. Last night he appeared to go suddenly mad. His actions had all the appearance of bestial insanity, yet I know that they must have been the result of long and careful planning. I heard a sound of fighting in the garden, and going to investigate, for I believed it was yourself being dragged down by my watchdog, I saw Thak emerge from the shrubbery dripping with blood. Before I was aware of his intention, he sprang at me with an awful scream and struck me senseless. I remember no more, but can only surmise that, following some whim of his semi-human brain, he stripped me of my gown and cast me still living into the pits. For what reason, only the gods can guess. He must have killed the dog when he came from the garden, and after he struck me down, he evidently killed Joka, as you saw the man lying dead in the house. Joko would have come to my aid even against Thak, whom he always hated.
Murillo stared in the mirror at the creature which sat with such monstrous patience before the closed door. He shuddered at the sight of the great black hands, thickly grown with hair that was almost fur-like. The body was thick, broad, and stooped. The unnaturally wide shoulders had burst the scarlet gown, and on these shoulders Murillo noted the same thick growth of black hair. The face peering from the scarlet hood was utterly bestial. And yet Murillo realized that Nabonidus spoke truth when he said that Thak was not wholly a beast. There was something in the red murky eyes, something in the creature's clumsy posture, something in the whole appearance of the thing that set it apart from the truly animal. That monstrous body housed a brain and soul that were just budding awfully into something vaguely human. Murillo stood aghast as he recognized a faint and hideous kinship between his kind and that squatting monstrosity, and he was nauseated by a fleeting realization of the abysses of bellowing bestiality up through which humanity had painfully toiled.
"Surely he sees us," muttered Conan. "Why does he not charge us? He could break this window with ease."
Murillo realized that Conan supposed the mirror to be a window through which they were looking.
"He does not see us," answered the priest. "We are looking into the chamber above us. That door that Thak is guarding is the one at the head of these stairs.
It is simply an arrangement of mirrors. Do you see those mirrors on the walls? They transmit the reflection of the room into these tubes, down which other mirrors carry it to reflect it at last on an enlarged scale in this great mirror.
Murillo realized that the priest must be centuries ahead of his generation to perfect such an invention. But Conan put it down to witchcraft and troubled his head no more about it.
"I constructed these pits for a place of refuge as well as a dungeon," the priest was saying. "There are times when I have taken refuge here, and through these mirrors watched doom fall upon those who sought me with ill intent."
"But why is Thak watching that door?" demanded Murillo.
"He must have heard the falling of the grating in the tunnel. It is connected with bells in the chambers above. He knows someone is in the pits, and he is waiting for him to come up the stairs. Oh, he has learned well the lessons I taught him. He has seen what happened to men who came through that door when I tugged at the rope that hangs on yonder wall, and he waits to mimic me."
"And while he waits, what are we to do?"
demanded Murillo.
"There is naught we can do except watch him. As long as he is in that chamber, we dare not ascend the stairs. He has the strength of a true gorilla, and could easily tear us all to pieces. But he does not need to exert his muscles. If we open that door, he has but to tug that rope and blast us into eternity."
"How?"
"I bargained to help you escape," answered the priest, "not to betray my secrets."
Murillo started to reply, then stiffened suddenly. A stealthy hand had parted the curtains of one of the doorways. Between them appeared a dark face, whose glittering eyes fixed menacingly on the squat form in the scarlet robe.
"Petraeus!"
hissed Nabonidus.
"Mitra, what a gathering of vultures this night is!"
The face remained framed between the parted curtains. Over the intruder's shoulder, other faces peered. Dark, thin faces, alight with sinister eagerness.
"What do they hear?"
muttered Murillo, unconsciously lowering his voice, although he knew they could not hear him.
"Why, what would Petraeus and his ardent young nationalists be doing in the house of the Red Priest?"
laughed Nabonidus.
"Look how eagerly they glare at the figure they think is their archenemy. They have fallen into your error. It should be amusing to watch their expressions when they are disillusioned."
Murillo did not reply. The whole affair had a distinctly unreal atmosphere. He felt as if he were watching the play of puppets, or as a disembodied ghost himself, impersonally viewing the actions of the living, his presence unseen and unsuspected. He saw Petraeus put his finger warningly to his lips and nod to his fellow conspirators. The young nobleman could not tell if Thak were aware of the intruders. The ape-man's position had not changed, as he sat with his back toward the door through which the men were gliding.
"They had the same idea you had," Nabonidus was muttering at his ear. "Only their reasons were patriotic rather than selfish. Easy to gain access to my house now that the dog is dead. Oh, what a chance to rid myself of their menace once and for all! If I was sitting where Thak sits, a leap to the wall, a tug on that rope!"
Petraeus had placed one foot lightly over the threshold of the chamber. His fellows were at his heels, their daggers glinting dully. Suddenly, Thak rose and wheeled toward him. The unexpected horror of his appearance, where they had thought to behold the hated but familiar countenance of Nabonidus, wrought havoc with their nerves, as the same spectacle had wrought upon Murillo. With a shriek, Petraeus recoiled, carrying his companions backward with him. They stumbled and floundered over each other, and in that instant, Thak, covering the distance in one prodigious, grotesque leap, caught and jerked powerfully at a thick velvet rope which hung near the doorway. Instantly, the curtains whipped back on either hand, leaving the door clear, and down across it something flashed with a peculiar silvery blur.
"He remembered!"
Nabonidus was exulting.
The beast is half a man. He had seen the doom performed, and he remembered. Watch now, watch, watch!
Murillo saw that it was a panel of heavy glass that had fallen across the doorway. Through it, he saw the pallid faces of the conspirators. Petraeus, throwing out his hands as if to ward off a charge from Thack, encountered the transparent barrier, and from his gestures said something to his companions. Now that the curtains were drawn back, the men in the pits could see all that took place in the chamber that contained the Nationalists. Completely unnerved, these ran across the chamber toward the door by which they had apparently entered, only to halt suddenly, as if stopped by an invisible wall.
"The jerk of the rope sealed that chamber," laughed Nabonidus. "It is simple. The glass panels work in grooves in the doorways. Jerking the rope trips the spring that holds them. They slide down and lock in place, and can only be worked from outside. The glass is unbreakable. A man with a mallet could not shatter it. Ah!"
The trapped men were in a hysteria of fright. They ran wildly from one door to another, beating vainly at the crystal walls, shaking their fists wildly at the implacable black shape which squatted outside. Then, one threw back his head, glared upward, and began to scream, to judge from the working of his lips, while he pointed toward the ceiling.
"The fall of the panels released the clouds of doom," said the Red Priest with a wild laugh. "The dust of the Grey Lotus, from the swamps of the dead beyond the land of Kitai."
In the middle of the ceiling hung a cluster of gold buds. These had opened like the petals of a great carven rose, and from them billowed a gray mist that swiftly filled the chamber. Instantly the scene changed from one of hysteria to one of madness and horror. The trapped men began to stagger. They ran in drunken circles. Froth dripped from their lips, which twisted as in awful laughter. Raging, they fell upon one another with daggers and teeth, slashing, tearing, slaying in a holocaust of madness. Murillo turned sick as he watched, and was glad that he could not hear the screams and howls with which that doomed chamber must be ringing. Like pictures thrown on a screen, it was silent. Outside the chamber of horror, Thack was leaping up and down in brutish glee, tossing his long hairy arms on high. At Murillo's shoulder, Nabonidus was laughing like a fiend.
"Ha ha ha! A good stroke, Petraeus! That fairly disemboweled him! Now one for you, my patriotic friend! So, they are all down, and the living tear the flesh of the dead with their slavering teeth!"
Murillo shuddered. Behind him, the Cimmerian swore softly in his uncouth tongue. Only death was to be seen in the chamber of the gray mist. Torn, gashed, and mangled, the conspirators lay in a red heap, gaping mouths and blood-dabbled faces staring blankly upward through the slowly swirling eddies of gray. Thack, stooping like a giant gnome, approached the wall where the rope hung and gave it a peculiar sidewise pull.
"He is opening the farther door," said Nabonidus. "By Mitra, he is more of a human than even I had guessed. See, the mist swirls out of the chamber and is dissipated. He waits to be safe. Now he raises the other panel. He is cautious. He knows the doom of the Grey Lotus, which brings madness and death. By Mitra!"
Murillo jerked about at the electric quality of the exclamation.
"Our one chance!" exclaimed Nabonidus. "If he leaves the chamber above for a few minutes, we will risk a dash up those stairs."
Suddenly tense, they watched the monster waddle through the doorway and vanish. With the lifting of the glass panel, the curtains had fallen again, hiding the chamber of death.
"We must chance it!" gasped Nabonidus,
and Murillo saw perspiration break out on his face.
"Perhaps he will be disposing of the bodies, as he has seen me do. Quick! Follow me up those stairs!"
He ran toward the steps and up them with an agility that amazed Murillo. The young nobleman and the barbarian were close at his heels, and they heard his gusty sigh of relief as he threw open the door at the top of the stairs. They burst into the broad chamber they had seen mirrored below. Thack was nowhere to be seen.
"He's in that chamber with the corpses," exclaimed Murillo. "Why not trap him there as he trapped them?"
"No, no!"
gasped Nabonidus, an unaccustomed pallor tinging his features.
"We do not know that he is in there. He might emerge before we could reach the trap rope anyway. Follow me into this corridor. I must reach my chamber and obtain weapons which will destroy him. This corridor is the only one opening from this chamber which is not set with a trap of some kind."
They followed him swiftly through a curtained doorway opposite the door of the death chamber, and came into a corridor, into which various chambers opened. With fumbling haste, Nabonidus began to try the doors on each side. They were locked, as was the door at the other end of the corridor.
"My God!"
The Red Priest leaned against the wall, his skin ashen.
"The doors are locked, and Thack took my keys from me. We are trapped after all."
Murillo stared appalled to see the man in such a state of nerves, and Nabonidus pulled himself together with an effort.
"That beast has me in a panic," he said. "If you had seen him tear men as I have seen. Well, Mitra aid us, but we must fight him now with what the gods have given us. Come!"
He led them back to the curtained doorway and peered into the great chamber in time to see Thack emerge from the opposite doorway. It was apparent that the beast man had suspected something. His small, close-set ears twitched. He glared angrily about him and approached the nearest doorway, tore aside the curtains to look behind them. Nabonidus drew back, shaking like a leaf. He gripped Conan's shoulder.
"Man, do you dare pitch your knife against his fangs?"
The Cimmerian's eyes blazed in answer.
"Quick!"
the Red Priest whispered, thrusting him behind the curtains, close against the wall.
"As he will find us soon enough, we will draw him to us. As he rushes past you, sink your blade in his back if you can. You, Murillo, show yourself to him and then flee up the corridor. Mitra knows we have no chance with him in hand-to-hand combat, but we are doomed anyway when he finds us."
Murillo felt his blood congeal in his veins, but he steeled himself and stepped outside the doorway. Instantly, Thack, on the other side of the chamber, wheeled, glared, and charged with a thunderous roar. His scarlet hood had fallen back, revealing his black, misshapen head. His black hands and red robe were splashed with a brighter red. He was like a crimson and black nightmare as he rushed across the chamber, fangs bared, his bowed legs hurtling his enormous body along at a terrifying gait. Murillo turned and ran back into the corridor, and quick as he was, the shaggy horror was almost at his heels. Then, as the monster rushed past the curtains, from among them catapulted a great form that struck full on the ape-man's shoulders, at the same instant driving the poniard into the brutish back. Thack screamed horribly as the impact knocked him off his feet, and the combatants hit the floor together. Instantly there began a whirl and thrash of limbs, and tearing and rending of a fiendish battle. Murillo saw that the barbarian had locked his legs about the ape-man's torso and was striving to maintain his position on the monster's back while he butchered it with his poniard. Thack, on the other hand, was striving to dislodge his clinging foe, to drag him around within reach of the giant fangs that gaped for his flesh. In a whirlwind of blows and scarlet tatters, they rolled along the corridor, revolving so swiftly that Murillo dared not use the chair he had caught up, lest he strike the Cimmerian. And he saw that in spite of the handicap of Conan's first hold, and the voluminous robe that lashed and wrapped about the ape-man's limbs and body, Thack's giant strength was swiftly prevailing. Inexorably, he was dragging the Cimmerian around in front of him. The ape-man had taken punishment enough to have killed a dozen men. Conan's poniard had sunk again and again into his torso, shoulders, and bull-like neck. He was streaming blood from a score of wounds, but unless the blade quickly reached some absolutely vital spot, Thak's inhuman vitality would survive to finish the Cimmerian. And after him, Conan's companions. Conan was fighting like a wild beast himself, in silence except for his gasps of effort. The black talons of the monster and the awful grasp of those misshapen hands ripped and tore at him. The grinning jaws gaped for his throat. Then Murillo, seeing an opening, sprang and swung the chair with all his power and with force enough to have brained a human being. The chair glanced from Thak's slanted black skull. But the stunned monster momentarily relaxed his rending grasp, and in that instant Conan, gasping and streaming blood, plunged forward and sank his poniard to the hilt in the ape-man's heart. With a convulsive shudder, the beast-man started from the floor, then sank limply back. His fierce eyes set and glazed. His thick limbs quivered and became rigid. Conan staggered dizzily up, shaking the sweat and blood out of his eyes. Blood dripped from his poniard and fingers and trickled in rivulets down his thighs, arms, and breast. Murillo caught at him to support him, but the barbarian shook him off impatiently.
"When I cannot stand alone, it will be time to die," he mumbled through mashed lips. "But I'd like a flagon of wine."
Nabonidus was staring down at the still figure as if he could not believe his own eyes. Black, hairy, abhorrent, the monster lay grotesque in the tatters of the scarlet robe, yet more human than bestial, even so, and possessed somehow of a vague and terrible pathos. Even the Cimmerian sensed this, for he panted,
"I have slain a man tonight, not a beast. I will count him among the chiefs whose souls I've sent into the dark, and my women will sing of him."
Nabonidus stooped and picked up a bunch of keys on a golden chain. They had fallen from the ape-man's girdle during the battle. Motioning his companions to follow him, he led them to a chamber, unlocked the door, and led the way inside. It was illumined like the others. The red priest took a vessel of wine from a table and filled crystal beakers. As his companions drank thirstily, he murmured,
"What a night! It is nearly dawn now. What of you, my friends?"
"I'll dress Conan's hurts if you will fetch me bandages and the like," said Murillo. And Nabonidus nodded and moved toward the door that led into the corridor. Something about his bowed head caused Murillo to watch him sharply. At the door, the red priest wheeled suddenly. His face had undergone a transformation. His eyes gleamed with his old fire. His lips laughed soundlessly.
"Rogues together!"
His voice rang with its accustomed mockery.
"But not fools together! You are the fool, Murillo!"
"What do you mean?" The young nobleman started forward.
"Back!"
Nabonidus's voice cracked like a whip.
"Another step and I will blast you!"
Murillo's blood turned cold as he saw that the red priest's hand grasped a thick velvet rope which hung among the curtains just outside the door.
"What treachery is this?" cried Murillo. "You swore—" "I swore I would not tell the king a jest concerning you. I did not swear not to take matters into my own hands if I could. Do you think I would pass up such an opportunity? Under ordinary circumstances, I would not dare to kill you myself without sanction of the king. But now none will ever know. You will go into the acid vats along with Thak and the nationalist fools, and none will be the wiser. What a night this has been for me! If I have lost some valuable servants, I have nevertheless rid myself of various dangerous enemies. Stand back! I am over the threshold, and you cannot possibly reach me before I tug this cord and send you to hell. Not the Grey Lotus this time, but something just as effective. Nearly every chamber in my house is a trap.
And so, Murillo, fool that you are!
Too quickly for the sight to follow, Conan caught up a stool and hurled it. Nabonidus instinctively threw up his arm with a cry, but not in time. The missile crunched against his head, and the red priest swayed and fell face down in a slowly widening pool of dark crimson.
His blood was red after all, grunted Conan.
Murillo raked back his sweat-plastered hair with a shaky hand as he leaned against the table, weak from the reaction of relief.
It is dawn, he said. Let us get out of here before we fall afoul of some other doom. If we can climb the outer wall without being seen, we won't be connected with this night's work. Let the police write their own explanation.
He glanced at the body of the Red Priest where it lay etched in crimson, and shrugged his shoulders.
He was the fool after all. Had he not paused to taunt us, he could have trapped us easily.
Well, said the Cimmerian tranquilly, he's traveled the road all rogues must walk at last.
I'd like to loot the house, but I suppose we'd best go.
As they emerged into the dimness of the dawn-whitened garden, Murillo said,
The Red Priest has gone into the dark, so my road is clear in the city, and I have nothing to fear.
But what of you? There is still the matter of that priest in the maze, and—
I'm tired of this city anyway, grinned the Cimmerian. You mentioned a horse waiting at the rat's den. I am curious to see how fast that horse can carry me into another kingdom. There's many a highway I want to travel before I walk the road Nabonidus walked this night.
The Vale of Lost Women. The thunder of the drums and the great elephant tusk horns was deafening, but in Livia's ears the clamor seemed but a confused muttering, dull and far away. As she lay on the Angareb in the great hut, her state bordered between delirium and semi-unconsciousness. Outward sounds and movements scarcely impinged upon her senses. Her whole mental vision, though dazed and chaotic, was yet centered with hideous certitude on the naked, writhing figure of her brother, blood streaming down the quivering thighs. Against a dim nightmare background of dusky, interweaving shapes and shadows, that white form was limned in merciless and awful clarity. The air seemed still to pulsate with an agonized screaming, mingled and interwoven obscenely with a rustle of fiendish laughter. She was not conscious of sensation as an individual, separate and distinct from the rest of the cosmos. She was drowned in a great gulf of pain, was herself but pain crystallized and manifested in flesh. So she lay without conscious thought or motion, while outside the drums bellowed, the horns clamored, and barbaric voices lifted hideous chants, keeping time to naked feet slapping the hard earth and open palms smiting one another softly. But through her frozen mentality, individual consciousness at last began slowly to seep. A dull wonder that she was still bodily unharmed first made itself manifest. She accepted the miracle without thanksgiving. The matter seemed meaningless. Acting mechanically, she sat up on the Angareb and stared dully about her. Her extremities made feeble beginnings of motions, as if responding to blindly awakening nerve centers. Her naked feet scuffled nervously at the hard, beaten dirt floor. Her fingers twitched convulsively at the skirt of the scanty undertunic which constituted her only garment. Impersonally, she remembered that once, it seemed long, long ago, rude hands had torn her other garments from her body, and she had wept with fright and shame. It seemed strange now that so small a wrong should have caused her so much woe. The magnitude of outrage and indignity was only relative, after all. Like everything else. The hut door opened, and a black woman entered, a lithe, pantherish creature whose supple body gleamed like polished ebony, adorned only by a wisp of silk twisted about her strutting loins. The whites of her eyeballs reflected the firelight outside as she rolled them with wicked meaning. She bore a bamboo dish of food, smoking meat, roasted yams, mealies, unwieldy ingots of native bread, and a vessel of hammered gold filled with Urati beer. These she set down on the Angareb, but Livia paid no heed. She sat staring dully at the opposite wall, hung with mats woven of bamboo shoots. The young black woman laughed evilly, with a flash of dark eyes and white teeth, and, with a hiss of spiteful obscenity and a mocking caress that was more gross than her language, she turned and swaggered out of the hut, expressing more taunting insolence with the motions of her hips than any civilized woman could with spoken insults. Neither the wench's words nor her actions had stirred the surface of Livia's consciousness. All her sensations were still turned inward. Still, the vividness of her mental pictures made the visible world seem like an unreal panorama of ghosts and shadows. Mechanically, she ate the food and drank the liquor without tasting either. It was still mechanically that at last she rose and walked unsteadily across the hut to peer out through a crack between the bamboos. It was an abrupt change in the timbre of the drums and horns that reacted upon some obscure part of her mind and made her seek the cause, without sensible volition. At first, she could make out nothing of what she saw. All was chaotic and shadowy, shapes moving and mingling, writhing and twisting, black formless blocks hewed out starkly against a setting of blood red that dulled and glowed. Then, actions and objects assumed their proper proportions, and she made out men and women moving about the fires. The red light glinted on silver and ivory ornaments. White plumes nodded against the glare. Naked black figures strutted and posed, silhouettes carved out of darkness and limned in crimson. On an ivory stool, flanked by giants in plumed headpieces and leopard-skin girdles, sat a fat, squat shape, abysmal, repulsive, a toad-like chunk of blackness reeking of the dank, rotting jungle and the nighted swamps. The creature's pudgy hands rested on the sleek arch of his belly. His nape was a roll of sooty fat that seemed to thrust his bullet head forward. His eyes gleamed in the firelight like live coals in a dead black stump. Their appalling vitality belied the inert suggestion of the gross body. As the girl's gaze rested on that repellent figure, her body stiffened and tensed as frantic life surged through her again. From a mindless automaton, she changed suddenly to a sentient mold of live, quivering flesh, stinging and burning. Pain was drowned in hate, so intense it in turn became pain. She felt hard and brittle, as if her body were turning to steel. She felt her hate flow almost tangibly out along the line of her vision.
So it seemed to her that the object of her emotion should fall dead from his carven stool because of its force.
But if Bajuj, king of Bakala, felt any psychic discomfort because of the concentration of his captive, he did not show it. He continued to cram his frog-like mouth to capacity with handfuls of mealies scooped up from a vessel held up to him by a kneeling woman, and to stare down a broad lane which was being formed by the action of his subjects in pressing back on either hand. Down this lane, walled with sweaty black humanity, Livia vaguely realized some important personage would come, judging from the strident clamor of drum and horn. And as she watched, one came.
A column of fighting men, marching three abreast, advanced toward the ivory stool. A thick line of waving plumes and glinting spears meandering through the motley crowd. At the head of the ebon spearmen strode a figure at the sight of which Livia started violently. Her heart seemed to stop, then began to pound again, suffocatingly. Against that dusky background, this man stood out with vivid distinctness. He was clad, like his followers, in leopard-skin loincloth and plumed headpiece. But he was a white man.
It was not in the manner of a suppliant or a subordinate that he strode up to the ivory stool. and sudden silence fell over the throng as he halted before the squatting figure. Livia felt the tenseness, though she only dimly knew what it portended. For a moment, Bajuj sat, craning his short neck upward like a great frog. Then, as if pulled against his will by the other's steady glare, he shambled up off his stool and stood grotesquely bobbing his shaven head. Instantly, the tension was broken. A tremendous shout went up from the masked villagers, and at a gesture from the stranger, his warriors lifted their spears and boomed a salute royale for King Bajuj. Whoever he was, Livia knew the man must indeed be powerful in that wild land, if Bajuj of Bakala rose to greet him. And power meant military prestige. Violence was the only thing respected by those ferocious races. Thereafter, Livia stood with her eyes glued to the crack in the hut wall, watching the white stranger. His warriors mingled with the Bakalas, dancing, feasting, swigging beer. He himself, with a few of his chiefs, sat with Bajuj and the head men of Bakala, cross-legged on mats, gorging and guzzling. She saw his hands dipped deep into the cooking pots with the others, saw his muzzle thrust into the beer vessel out of which Bajuj also drank. But she noticed, nevertheless, that he was accorded the respect due a king. Since he had no stool, Bajuj renounced his also, and sat on the mats with his guest. When a new pot of beer was brought, the king of Bakala barely sipped it before he passed it to the white man. Power! All this ceremonial courtesy pointed to power, strength, prestige. Livia trembled in excitement as a breathless plan began to form in her mind. So she watched the white man with painful intensity, noting every detail of his appearance. He was tall. Neither in height nor in massiveness was he exceeded by many of the giant blacks. He moved with the lithe suppleness of a great panther. When the firelight caught his eyes, they burned like blue fire. High-strapped sandals guarded his feet, and from his broad girdle hung a sword in a leather scabbard. His appearance was alien and unfamiliar. Livia had never seen his like, but she made no effort to classify his position among the races of mankind. It was enough that his skin was white. The hours passed, and gradually the roar of revelry lessened as men and women sank into drunken sleep. At last, Bajuj rose tottering and lifted his hands, less a sign to end the feast than a token of surrender in the contest of gorging and guzzling, and stumbling was caught by his warriors, who bore him to his hut. The white man rose, apparently none the worse for the incredible amount of beer he had quaffed, and was escorted to the guest hut by such of the Bakala headmen as were able to reel along. He disappeared into the hut, and Livia noticed that a dozen of his own spearmen took their places about the structure, spears ready. Evidently, the stranger was taking no chances on Bajuj's friendship. Livia cast her glance about the village, which faintly resembled a dusky night of judgment, what with the straggling streets strewn with drunken shapes. She knew that men in full possession of their faculties guarded the outer boma, but the only wakeful men she saw inside the village were the spearmen about the white man's hut, and some of these were beginning to nod and lean on their spears. With her heart beating hammer-like, she glided to the back of her prison hut and out the door, passing the snoring guard Bajuj had set over her. Like an ivory shadow, she glided across the space between her hut and that occupied by the stranger. On her hands and knees, she crawled up to the back of that hut. A black giant squatted here, his plumed head sunk on his knees. She wriggled past him to the wall of the hut. She had first been imprisoned in that hut, and a narrow aperture in the wall, hidden inside by a hanging mat, represented her weak and pathetic attempt at escape. She found the opening, turned sidewise, and wriggled her lithe body through, thrusting the inner mat aside. Firelight from without faintly illuminated the interior of the hut. Even as she thrust back the mat, she heard a muttered curse, felt a vice-like grasp in her hair, and was dragged bodily through the aperture and plumped down on her feet. Staggering with the suddenness of it, she gathered her scattered wits together and raked her disordered tresses out of her eyes to stare up into the face of the white man who towered over her, amazement written on his dark, scarred face. His sword was naked in his hand, and his eyes blazed like balefire, whether with anger, suspicion, or surprise, she could not judge. He spoke in a language she could not understand, a tongue which was not a Negro guttural, yet did not have a civilized sound.
"Oh, please," she begged, "not so loud. They will hear."
"Who are you?" he demanded, speaking Ophirian with a barbarous accent. "By Crom, I never thought to find a white girl in this hellish land."
"My name is Livia," she answered. "I am Bajuja's captive. Oh, listen, please listen to me. I cannot stay here long. I must return before they miss me from my hut."
"My brother—"
A sob choked her, then she continued.
"My brother was Thedalese, and we were of the house of Chelkas, scientists and noblemen of Ophir. By special permission of the king of Stygia, my brother was allowed to go to Keshata, the city of magicians, to study their arts, and I accompanied him. He was only a boy, younger than myself."
Her voice faltered and broke. The stranger said nothing, but stood watching her with burning eyes, his face frowning and unreadable. There was something wild and untamable about him that frightened her and made her nervous and uncertain.
"The black Kushites raided Keshata," she continued hurriedly. "We were approaching the city in a camel caravan. Our guards fled and the raiders carried us away with them. But they did us no harm, and let us know that they would parley with the Stygians and accept a ransom for our return. But one of the chiefs desired all the ransom for himself, and he and his followers stole us out of the camp one night and fled far to the southeast with us, to the very borders of Kush. There they were attacked and cut down by a band of Bakala raiders. Thetales and I were dragged into this den of beasts."
She sobbed convulsively.
"This morning my brother was mutilated and butchered before me."
She gagged and went momentarily blind at the memory.
"They fed his body to the jackals. How long I lay in a faint, I do not know."
Words failing her, she lifted her eyes to the scowling face of the stranger. A mad fury swept over her. She lifted her fists and beat futilely on his mighty breast, which he heeded no more than the buzzing of a fly.
"How can you stand there like a dumb brute?"
she screamed in a ghastly whisper.
"Are you but a beast like these others? Ah, Mitra, once I thought there was honor in men. Now I know each has his price. You, what do you know of honor, or of mercy, or decency? You are a barbarian like these others. Only your skin is white. Your soul is black as theirs. You care not that a man of your own color has been foully done to death by these black dogs, that a white woman is their slave.